Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3070, United States of America versus Dwayne Philip Jones, also known as Chicken Jones, appellant. Ms. Davis for the appellant, Mr. Coleman for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. Please report. I'm Mary Davis, and I represent the appellant in this case, Dwayne Jones. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal. The issue I'd like to discuss this morning is the first issue in the appellant's brief, and that is whether the public safety exception to the Miranda requirements apply in this case. There is no dispute as to what the facts are in this case. They are basically that Mr. Jones had an outstanding warrant for a murder that occurred approximately 6.5 weeks before his arrest.
Ms. Davis, could I ask you just to skip for one moment to the whether it's a harmless error, even if it is an error question. So he had the gun on him, right?
He had the gun, yes.
Yes, and there was no objection to the admission of the gun.
Well, there was an argument. The defense was that.
The defense was that he didn't have a gun.
Right, exactly.
But there was no objection from a Fourth Amendment point of view to the discovery of the gun.
That's correct.
Okay. So, what is the difference if your defense is and only by inference, I take it, because the defendant didn't testify,
exactly.
Right? All right? So, if your defense is that he didn't actually have the gun, if the officer said he had the gun, why would the jury more likely believe the officer saying he said he had a burner rather than the jury believing that they actually found a gun? What's the difference?
I think the difference is that you have the statement from the defendant that's admitting to the gun evidence.
Right, but the only evidence that he actually made that statement is the officer saying so. And if the jury is inclined to believe the officers that he had the gun on him, then it clearly had possession. And if they're therefore the statement doesn't mean anything. And if instead they're inclined to not believe the officers' statement that they saw him with a gun on him, why would they believe the officer's statement that he made a statement that he had a gun on him?
I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think the answer to that question is that the statement kind of tips the scales. It's one more piece of evidence. I think when juries look at things, they look at, you know, the individual pieces of evidence. And here you have, if you had just the officer saying, I found the gun, and then you have the defense saying he couldn't have had the gun, well, then you've got those two competing arguments as far as whether the defendant possessed the gun. However, once you put in there a statement where he admits he has a gun, then I think that's one more piece of evidence.
Even though the evidence is the same, it's the officer's testimony.
It's the officer's testimony, but it's an additional piece of evidence that for the jury to consider. And the jury can, of course, you know, disregard any pieces of evidence. I think they're instructed that they don't have to accept every bit of evidence that's presented to them. But at the same time, you have this one more piece of evidence for them to consider.
Related to Judge Garland's questions, it's always going to be the case when it's a statement about something on the person of the suspect that the officers would have uncovered that evidence anyway as part of the search incident to arrest. So I'm not sure the stakes here are as high as you're suggesting. In other words, even if nothing had been said here, after the arrest, there would have been the search incident to arrest, and the gun would have been discovered.
There's no doubt that they would have found the gun, regardless of whether the statement was made or not, clearly, because they did search him, you know, and they would have searched him as a result of the arrest. But at the same time, I think it's the statement that kind of took away any possibility of a defense in this case, because the defense was given that, I mean, even the police officers testified the way Mr. Jones was running, it sounded very awkward that he had his hands bent, you know, up in the air and waving his hands. So clearly he didn't have a gun in his hands at that time.
But wouldn't it be the same defense? The officers lied about seeing the gun and they lied about the statement. That's the defense. Why is it any better if they just, why is this defense any better if all you have to prove is that they lied about the gun as compared to lied about the statement? There's no corroboration other than the officer's testimony about either one.
Well, right, but I get back to the point that I think when a jury hears, you know, that a statement was made, then that is just one more piece of evidence. I mean, of course, you know, the defense can always argue that the police are lying, but then I think there comes a point for the juries where, you know, how much are they lying? How much are they lying about? Why would they lie about this? Okay? To say that they're lying about where the gun was is one thing. To say that they're lying about everything, I think that's a stretch, and I think it makes it a more difficult, puts the defendant in a more difficult position. And given we have the, you know, the standard of review, I think that it's clear that the statement was very harmful.
To take you back to the premise of your argument, the facts here seem extraordinary. Suspect for murder, mm-hmm, runs, causes a chase. Officers hear a gunshot. Why isn't this the classic case for a public safety exception?
I think it's because there has been no case that I've been able to find, nor that the government was able to find, where there has been that long of a stretch between the time when the person was in possession of a firearm and when they're actually arrested.
But if it's someone suspected of murder with a firearm, right?
Right.
Even if it's, I guess I fail to see that, if it's 6 weeks ago as opposed to a few days ago, that makes a difference? Because some of the cases are separated by days at least, right?
There was the D.C. Court of Appeals case where it was separated, and they didn't believe that the defendant had the gun on him. They believed he put it in his home where there were children present, which I think is a different situation than actually having a gun on him. There's case law that says that drug dealers routinely carry guns. I haven't been able to find a case that says people who committed murder routinely carry guns.
How about people who commit murder and run at the sight of the officers and lead them on a chase?
I haven't found a case that says that either. I mean,
well, put aside the precedent, though, just common sense, right?
I think the obvious reason that Mr. Jones would run and the logical, reasonable reason he would run is because he knew they were coming to arrest him. I don't think one can infer because he had a charge for murder and he ran that he was in possession of a gun. I think people run when they know they're going to be arrested, not because they're in possession of a gun. And I don't think you can make the inference that just because someone is charged with murder that they are going to be in possession of a gun or possibly two guns 6.5 weeks later. I haven't been able to find any case where that inference is ever made. If this court were to say the public safety exception applies in situations like this, anytime someone is arrested for murder, then the public safety exception would have to apply. And I just don't think that the rule goes that far.
Could I ask you about, I know you weren't going to put this in the oral argument, but I have questions about both of your other points, if you don't mind. On the DEA 7, I'm having difficulty looking at the transcript, seeing that the third page actually was presented to the jury. I've gone carefully over it. There is the usual confusion caused by the fact that witnesses and defense lawyers and prosecutors all refer to the DEA 7 as the whole package. But in this case, it seems pretty clear that, at least to me, it seemed relatively clear anyway, that the only thing that went before the jury was the lab report, and certainly the only thing that went back to the jury was a lab report. Do you agree with the latter part, that the only thing that went back to the
jury? I agree that the only thing that went back to it was the lab report.
Okay, so then the only thing we're talking about is whether up on the screen was shown the DEA 7, the actual page, which is the page on which the police report what they're finding and passing it on, right?
Right.
And what in those pages makes you think that that page was actually on the screen?
I think the best answer for that is that the transcripts at best are confusing, and it's really not clear what was on the screen. There was an objection made, I think, at the request of Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones requested that his attorney object because that page was up on the screen and it shouldn't be.
We don't, so when see, they I, don't, went up, No, if that were the case, I would understand, but I just don't see that. The only objection I see is he has the wrong side on there.
Right.
But the side, first of all, the word side sounds like it's the back rather than the front, not the third, not the wrong page. There's no reference to the, even at the bench conference, there's no reference to the murder warrant.
I don't have the transcript right in front of me, but I think when they went up to the bench, I think the attorney said he's got the wrong page
so
up
Mr.
there on
Moore's,
the wrong side.
Sean right. Moore is the lawyer, right?
Right,
so he
exactly.
says, Your Honor, he has the wrong side on there. Mm-hmm. Then the court says something which doesn't have anything to do with any of the pages we have, which says you need to make sure that none of the also on the gun stuff that you don't have on the front. And then Barnett says, Barnett is what the second prosecutor says, he used the report itself, not this. And Moore says, that's what I thought he was using. And then Barnett says he didn't use the 7, namely he didn't use the document that has the murder warrant. He used this. Of course, we don't know what this is. And then the judge says, okay, well, you need to redact it anyway, from which I took it to be mean to be safe. And then the court says what you have on the screen is a laboratory report itself, which is not the 7, it's the lab report.
It was Mr. Jones's reading of that transcript when the judge said you had to redact it. It was when Mr. Jones read that transcript, it was his position that the judge believed that the DEA 7 with
okay.
the language
when you say,
was...
just so I understand, when you say it was his position, you mean in, you don't mean in anything that's before the court? Mr. Jones.
It's just only the transcript, which is before the court. Oh, it was
right. I can only from reading.
His reading of that.
I understand. At the most, how long would this document have been on the screen in any event?
Probably seconds.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And then one last question. Sorry. On the remand issue, which is an issue I, I had another case about this. I think it's Pettigrew or something, where I asked both sides whether there was any difference with respect to remanding versus requiring the defendant to file a motion. Is there any difference?
I don't think there is any difference, and I think the proper. I think the way these are being handled now, that everything is settled, right?
Just
is
sent that back down.
Is there? It's just yeah. The after the case is done in the court.
So
of
there
appeals.
Are no collateral consequences whatsoever. I think the difference is whether we affirm and leave it to your client to file something in the district court, or whether we actually say we're going to remand. Do you care?
I don't think it matters because the motion will be filed either way.
My question is whether if we affirm the judgment of conviction.
Exactly. Then
do you think there's any collateral consequence to your client as a result of doing that as distinct from saying we affirm and we remand the sentence to the district court?
I think remanding the sentence to the district court is a little bit more powerful for the
Are there
the
any
defendant,
collateral
I,
consequences?
I don't believe that there are.
You would
All right, in terms of early release or placement within the Bureau of Prisons or subsequent prosecutions, it would make no difference whether there was an affirmance as distinct from a remand on the sentence.
I don't believe that there is.
All right, the prosecutor can help us on that too. Thanks.
You'd still have to file some piece of paper, namely a motion of some kind.
A motion.
Whether we remand or don't remand, you have to
A motion has to be filed in any event.
All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank
we'll
you.
We'll hear from the prosecutor. More correctly, we'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Nick Coleman for the United States. The district court's ruling that appellant's statement fell under the public safety exception to Miranda should be affirmed. Under the Supreme Court's decision in New York v. Quarles, Officer Cyphers was fully justified in asking appellant what he had on him because, as the court has noted, he and his fellow marshals were trying to arrest a man wanted for armed murder with a gun, and in fact, they had information to suggest that he actually taken the gun from his victim. Appellant had prior convictions for weapons and drug offenses. The area was known for drug activity and violence, and it's being particularly dangerous for law enforcement officers. A gunshot went off during the chase. The officer saw small children as he and the appellant ran into the stairwell, and in any case, this was a residential building. The officer believed he was alone when he had tackled appellant. The appellant was still not handcuffed and secured. The appellant was wearing
Suppose he had been handcuffed and the question came afterwards.
Your Honor, because this inquiry is one that is looks, we believe, to the totality of the circumstances which the officer is facing. In other words, what the Supreme Court called in Quarles the kaleidoscopic situation. That is one factor which goes into the mix as to whether or not an officer believes that there is an immediate danger that needs to be addressed. Obviously, if the appellant is handcuffed, that may take away one small element of danger, but it doesn't negate all of these other elements of danger. But it was one extra factor which Officer Cyphers had to put into the mix as he decided whether or not to ask this question.
What's to prevent a holding in your favor in this case from allowing the police standard practice to ask questions like this before Miranda warnings?
There's nothing in our position which prevents that, Your Honor, for the simple reason that in the situation that we've outlined here,
Is it standard practice now to ask questions about what weapons the suspect might be carrying before the Miranda warnings are given?
Your Honor, I'm not personally aware as to whether or not in each department there is an official policy as to whether or not MPD officers or park police officers, et cetera, always ask when they make an arrest, whether they usually do, whether it's just the personal practice of each officer. There was no testimony here that I recall seeing that Officer Cyphers said it was the marshal's policy always to ask this question. I believe that his testimony was that he generally, in this situation, will ask that question. And we think that in this kind of a situation where he's chasing after a suspect for armed murder, that it was appropriate for him to ask that question, given all of these factors.
He went a little further, though, didn't he? I mean, his question was far broader. He explained why, but it was a broader question.
I don't believe, Your Honor, that it was far broader than simply a question about weapons. What he said is, do you have anything on you?
I suppose the guy gave him some drugs.
Your Honor, the question was general in the sense that what he was looking for was beyond simply, say, a gun, because as the officer testified, there are certain kinds of drug paraphernalia that can be dangerous to his hands when he's searching, such as hypodermic needles.
That makes it a lot broader, though, right? You don't have it. You didn't have any evidence of any recent drug dealing or drug use or anything like that. So,
Your Honor,
if he was asking for, if he would be allowed to ask for looking for needles, and anybody would be allowed to ask in any situation about needles, right?
I don't think so, Your Honor, for the simple reason you do have here an officer who's chasing a suspect in an area that's known for drug activity, and he's chasing somebody who he knows
as I think other judges have pointed out, there are large parts of the city, and most of the arrests we see are ones which are followed by the words, an area known for drug activity. So if that's the rule, then officers would be able to ask anywhere if all they're asking for is something like that.
Yes, Your Honor, and again, it's only one factor. The government's position is not that it's going to be the decisive factor if it's the only factor in every case, but it was one thing that goes into the mix. In addition to that, this particular gentleman also had a prior felony conviction for cocaine distribution.
That was 9 years ago.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And cocaine is not usually administered with a needle.
Not you.
Certainly 9 years ago it was not administered with a needle.
Understood, Your Honor. However, in this case, what the officer, the standard here is not something akin to preponderance of the evidence. It's what is reasonable and what is objectively reasonable. And we believe that because there is a risk to the officer from such a search, and the Supreme Court said in Quarles, it referred to not just the risk to the public, but also to the officer, involved, that it is appropriate in this kind of a situation for the officer to ask a question. And again, it's only one question he's asking. Do you have anything on you? And in this case, it's designed, as he said, because there are things other than just a gun that could hurt him. And we think that that is a reasonable thing for an officer to ask in this situation.
If it weren't an arrest on a murder warrant, would it be a reasonable thing? If it was not an arrest on a murder warrant. If it was just an arrest on possession with intent to distribute.
Well, Your Honor, in that case, the most of the circuit cases applying this have said that if the information that the officers are operating on is that this person is actively involved in drug activity. And in this case, if you were talking about a warrant for drug trafficking, let's say, or drug dealing, then that would be a factor which would go into the mix that would make it reasonable to ask the question.
Well, we have, I would say, I don't know, at least once a sitting, a case involving officers observing or otherwise arresting somebody for possession with intent to distribute. Now, are you saying that in every one of those cases, the public safety exception applies, and in every one of those cases, it's all right to ask without waiting for giving Miranda?
Your Honor, it would be one factor that would go into the mix.
I'm telling you, there's only two factors in most of these cases. One, the officer maybe saw the distribution, and two, it's in an area known for drug dealing, which, of course, is defined by the fact that there was just drug dealing in the area. In those cases, if those are the only two factors, I'm giving you a hard question, but I believe it's a question that reflects many of our cases, probably all of Felony 2s in Superior Court. In those situations, is the officer free to ask that question without giving Miranda, in your view?
Your Honor, I believe that the other circuits that have addressed that question, in other words, where the only things which the officers knew were that it was an area known for drug activity, and that they suspected this particular person of drug activity, then in fact the circuits upheld the question.
I've been on the court 11 years. I've never seen a public safety exception case, and when we look, except for that Brown case. In all that time, I've seen a lot of drug cases, and I was a prosecutor for a long time, and I never saw a case in which we had to defend on this ground. And I'm just wondering whether, in fact, this happens every day, or whether we would be opening the floodgates to a completely new kind of strategy here. Is my experience simply idiosyncratic or unusual? Or
I would have to step a bit outside the record, Your Honor. I can tell you,
of course.
I can say anecdotally that I know from dealing with such cases at the Superior Court level that it's a question which is frequently asked. I don't know that there is a specific policy, so I want to caveat what I say as not necessarily being a study or anything like that or an official.
And you don't know whether the evidence was admitted or suppressed where that happened either. But let me ask you, is it your statement here that you know of no guidelines that have been issued by the Attorney General regarding this?
I don't know the answer
on Quarles
to that question, Your Honor.
All right.
I don't know that the Attorney General, whether he's issued a policy to that. I can get back to the court if I find out to the contrary, certainly. But I'm not personally aware that there is such a directive to Department of Justice personnel.
We ask you on the remand question. Do you think there's any difference between, I think the way the Ninth Circuit and the other circuits do it is they affirm, and then they remand for a chance for the defendant to file his motion, as compared to affirm and then say nothing, and then the defendant files motion separately somehow.
Or affirm without prejudice, as the Fourth Circuit did.
Your Honor, as the government said in its brief, our position is that this court should affirm this case.
I know your position. Is there a difference between the two? Is there any consequence?
Any collateral consequences? When I was talking with appellate counsel, suggested, you know, hypothetically, Bureau of Prison Standards, subsequent prosecutions, sentencing guidelines, all those things.
I am aware of none, Your Honor. It is not my understanding, or certainly I have never been informed that the Bureau of Prisons, for example, keeps prisoners in certain areas because their cases are still pending on appeal, as opposed to whether they filed a collateral motion.
How many? Convictions they have.
Your Honor, again, I'm just not aware that there is such a policy, so I'm not aware that there are any collateral consequences for a defendant from being in the procedural position of either filing a motion which he has
I can think of cases where we used to have parole that there were consequences for a defendant. I mean, they just added up the number of convictions affirmed on appeal. I mean, there were guidelines to that effect now. That system is no longer with us, but I don't know about other systems that may exist. But you're representing to the court that you know of no collateral consequences to a defendant where, in this situation, where the Sentencing Commission has changed a guideline. If this court were to affirm, then your position is just leave it to the defendant whether or not he wants to file a motion in the district court for a reduction of sentence.
That is our position, Your Honor, and again, I'm not aware of any collateral consequences, certainly not in terms of, for example, sentence computation as to whether or not he served his time, that there's no difference between having a case affirmed but remanded for further proceedings as opposed to simply filing a motion in the district court to have this issue addressed. If he wants to file that motion, he can, and the district judge in this case can consider that argument on its merits. I don't really see that there's any particular
Other circuits really don't, or do they, give us any guidance to their thinking when they say we remand or we affirm without prejudice?
I'm not aware of any other circuits that have described there being any particular difference between the two. I mean, I suppose, obviously.
No, but they've used different language, and the question is why.
Of that, I'm not.
Be diplomatic.
All right.
May I ask one more follow-up on the question I was asking earlier, and then Judge Garland was asking about why this doesn't come up much. Maybe the stakes really aren't that large in these situations because the evidence on the person is going to be immediately found anyway by the police officers, part of the search incident to arrest. You don't really gain anything from asking what do you have on you when you're immediately searching.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that is the case, that because this is evidence that is going to be inevitably discovered, and because, as Your Honor's indicated in questioning of my appellate colleague here, the source of the information about the statement and about the gun is the same person, namely the officers, and it's the same defense against their credibility that was at issue here.
I take it on the DEA-7, your position is that the DEA-7 itself was not shown to the jury?
We certainly don't have any reason to think from this transcript or from the record here that that was ever shown. We have no reason to believe it otherwise, that this information was shown to the jury. And given that this is a case of plain error, the burden is clearly on the appellant to establish error.
Even if it were a case of harmless error, doesn't the defendant at least have to establish the facts that would show that the document went back to the jury? Is that
Your Honor,
obligation?
Yes, in the sense that it is essentially appellant's burden, whoever is the appellant has the burden of showing error to this court, of providing a record that shows error. And we don't think that this record shows error because it simply doesn't show that this particular information was provided to the jury.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And with that, the government would respectfully request that the district court's decision be affirmed.
Counsel for appellant, we'll give you a minute.
Thank you. I would only like to note that even in cases like this, that the evidence would have been or the gun would have been found inevitably as a result of the search, it's still important that we keep in mind that Quarles is an exception. It's not the rule. And if the evidence comes in anyway, I think it's a message needs to be sent to the police.
But don't you agree it's much different if the question is, for example, an arrest in the house, what's in the house? Or an arrest, you know, if you're arrested outside your house, what do you have in your car is much different from what do you have on your person, because I think the Second Circuit in Estrada pointed this out. The evidence was immediately going to be found anyway. I mean, it's just a different, and Quarles itself was much more significant, for example, than this case in terms of pointing out where the evidence was. Well,
exactly, but unless a message is sent that Quarles is an exception, the police are going to be asking these questions, do you have anything on you? And it will become the rule rather than the exception. And that's the point we are trying to make.
Thank you.
There's any other questions?
Take the case under advisement.
Thank you.
Thank you for your service.